way or fear of you or anything.
I have a most interesting subject to discuss with you this morning. The singing ministry of our Lord and Savior. When we were children in Sabbath school.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Fundamentalists Podcast. My name is Elliot Morgan. I am here with Peter Rollins. This is a podcast where we explore life and we explore different ideas and we tell stories and we laugh. And Pete talks about philosophy and sometimes I talk about my life and sometimes we go off on tangents and it's really fun and I'm having a great time doing it.
Yeah.
I feel like we're really hitting our stride after the 18th episode. I think this might be episode 18 or something.
Oh my
like that.
Goodness. Yeah, that's what I felt like, it was going to take us a while to really figure out our format, the theme, how it runs.
Yeah.
And I feel we're getting there.
We're getting
I'm worried now we're saying that we're going to mess it up.
This one is definitely falling off the rails. Yeah. And the reason it's falling off the rails is because I've been lucky enough to be very busy lately. And one of the side effects of that is I woke up this morning and I did the math in my head about us staying on top of this podcast. And I was like, oh, we have to film right now record right now because I have to go do it. Blah, 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 blah. And yeah. Can you do this in half an hour? And for those of you who aren't aware, or if you're just joining us on this podcast, the way it typically works is I say hi and hello, which is what I'm doing now. And then Pete does a reflection. We have some anecdotes. We have a couple takeaways. And that's the format of the podcast. But the only thing that requires preparation or an extensive amount of preparation is the actual reflection. And I just sprung it on you about half an hour.
Yeah, ago. 20 minutes ago, I just got a text while I'm lying in bed saying, let's do stoicism.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay.
I like how it went from half an hour to 20 minutes. In 10 minutes, you're going to be like, you gave me 5 minutes to come up with something. We did an episode last week. If you didn't get a chance to listen to it, it's called Duped. I think it's the best episode we've done yet. It's really fun. No updates to that story, which I won't spoil anything for it if you haven't heard it before. But also, this podcast is brought to you by the lovely folks at Wink, which is WINC. And if you would like to support the podcast, which many of you are, and thank you so much, let us know how you like the wine. I think it's amazing. But Wink is a wine club that can basically decide what kind of wine you would like based off of some kind of a palate quiz that you can take at trywink.com/fundamentalists or trywink.com/thefundamentalists. That's WINC. And you get $25 off your order of wine, and it helps us do this podcast and make sure that it sounds okay and that it gets actually uploaded because we're falling apart. But speaking of falling apart, some folks have reached out a couple times, numerous times, about the idea of stoicism. I love stoicism. Yep. I'm a big fan. We're going to get into it. I know you've got some critiques of it and some positive stuff to say about it. I'm very excited about this episode. Yeah. So Pete, please dive in.
Okay, well, as I say, Elliot didn't give me a lot of time.
No time.
Initially, when you said, let's do stoicism, I'm like, okay, I'm going to have to try to go in the back of my mind and remember learning about Stoics. But actually, it all came back. And Stoicism, the reason I know you want to do this is because there's been a revival in Stoicism.
I love it.
There's contemporary Stoicism. Everyone's into it. That, meditation, yoga, they're all kind
love
of,
all
of making a comeback. And I think we'll probably kind of delve into why that is a little bit.
I can't wait. Yeah. I love it. This is going to be fun.
Because I have a slight critique of some of it, which is that it works.
Yeah.
That worries me. But then we'll come back to that in a second. But the Stoics, yes, are like an incredible philosophical school that was set up in around the 3rd century BC in Greece by a guy called Zeno. And it was one of the predominant forms of philosophy. Its main rival was Epicureanism, which was kind of like a materialist philosophy. And Stoicism was what's called more idealist philosophy. And so Stoicism was massive. Some of its big adherents were Seneca, Epictetus, and then Marcus Aurelius, you like.
Yep.
So it's a complex and big school of thought. But ultimately, the Stoics were inspired by the death of Socrates. So this is one of the main things. So Socrates famously was brought to court because he was accused of not believing in the gods and of corrupting the minds of the youth, among other things. And so he was imprisoned and he was sentenced to death. And Socrates was a very powerful man and he could have challenged this. In fact, he could have likely escaped, left Greece or whatever and set up somewhere else. But he didn't. He abided by the court. He abided by their rule. He respected the rule of the country, even though he disagreed with it. He kind of went, well, this is what you guys want. And whenever he was in prison, they gave him hemlock and he drank it himself freely. And the only thing he did before drinking the hemlock, if I remember correctly, is he had a debt that he had to pay. And he said, listen, would you remember to pay that debt? Then he drank the hemlock and died. And so the Stoics, you know, that were very impressed by this lack of fear of death.
Which goes to show that even if you're Socrates, is this,
yep.
Even if you're Socrates, you can't make enough money to support yourself.
You're still a debt.
you still have debt. Yeah. And you can't even.
You're only going to pay your debts when you're dead.
Yeah, the most famous philosopher of all time still wasn't killing it in the financial department.
And he was a wrestler as well. I think he was making good money as a wrestler at one point.
Really?
Yeah, It was Socrates was a wrestler. I mean, it might have been Plato, but I'm pretty sure it was Socrates.
A wrestler?
Yeah. So Mike would like him.
Yeah, you're right. Mike Falzone, everybody. Yep. He's a huge... That's funny. I'm going to tell him that. We finally have a way to bridge the gap between his interests and my interests.
There it is.
Perfect.
It is Socrates. Yeah, so that was... that story was captured the imagination of people. You know, this guy who was... Oh, yeah, because he didn't fear death. And so for the Stoics, that means he loved life. Because do you remember... What was the famous... Woody Allen movie where he starts with that little joke where he says two women are in a restaurant and they're eating this food and one of them is saying this food is disgusting, it's cold, it's difficult to eat, I can't digest it, and then the other woman says I know and look how little they gave us, right?
Yeah.
And then Woody Allen does the thing about life is that we can despise our lives, we hate life, and yet weirdly we cling on to it for dear life.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a Stoic insight. For Seneca, he said that the more people pursue happiness, the more unhappy they become. But weirdly, the more addicted to life they become. So there's this, what Freud later called it death drive, but this weird thing where we're pursuing our own happiness and contentment that leads us to find life difficult and painful, and yet weirdly attaches us more deeply to it. Whereas for the Stoic, they're able to assume death, not fear it, not try to avoid it. And in doing that, they actually enjoy life more and taste life in a deeper way. So
wow, it's great.
A nice Stoic insight.
That's nice.
Yeah. So there you go. There's just a brief overview of kind of the original Stoic notions. they were
You get choked up. You get emotional. It's a lot. You got a lot going on. I can see there's tears in your eyes.
Seneca, you know, brings up a lot of emotion.
Yeah, it's all all that Stoic stuff.
Well,
really
this is a Stoic thing.
Tear-jerking.
I've had this cough for ages, and it's probably something terrible, but I'm being very Stoic about it.
Yeah. I remember when we went out and we saw Deadpool, and then we were getting a drink afterward, and I was like, if it turns out that this cough is like something really serious, it's like, I'm going to be kind of sad, and I want you to know that. It's going to keep me up for days.
I know. I was very touched by that. I was like, oh, that's
oh, really?
Lovely. That was really nice. If I die of throat cancer, you'd be upset.
I would be upset, yeah.
And not just because I wasn't paying my part of the rent.
Yeah, I mean, there's other reasons.
Yeah.
I'm sure there are other reasons.
Yeah, well, you can have the coffee machine.
Great. That coffee machine is doing wonders for me right now. I feel like I'm on drugs. It's perfect. I've had, like, I think technically four coffees right now, like, because I hit the brew two at a time.
Oh, yeah. And you go to extra strong.
And then I do extra strong and extra long, and I don't even know what that means.
Yes.
I just know it puts more coffee in the cup. So anyway, the Stoicism thing, man, I love it. I love all that stuff. I have a book that I have a little morning routine that I do that my friends sometimes make fun of me for, but that's fine because they're dumb. But I do a thing where I read this book on, it's called The Daily Stoic, and it's like a Stoic meditation or whatever. And it's just nice. It's a nice little paragraph thing, and it's a ritual. And then I do a little journaling, and then I know you're getting choked up again. And then I do meditate pretty regularly, but nothing crazy. Like, I'm not trying to, like, meet my spirit guide or anything. I've met Gary, and he's a fine guy. But I enjoy doing it very much. But there's an interesting thing, I think, that happens where it's like, if you get too much into that stuff, and I certainly am into that, and I think I'm naturally not super reactive and not super emotional. Like, we were talking last week about, like, I don't think you've ever seen me get angry.
You're a pretty chill guy,
chill cucumber. And it's interesting because I think for a lot of people, and I see this on the internet a lot, that's like a goal that they aspire to, is just sort of like calmness. And I have these conversations with my friends where some of them get, they're more emotionally reactive to things and things bother them more, and they just truly don't, they don't affect me very much. But that said, I think there's a flip side to it that I've experienced where it's like, I can't even, I find myself unable to like access the stuff that's going on there. And I know we're talking a little bit about the pros and cons of Stoicism, but a con from what I've experienced in my life is that it can actually be this thing that leads me, I can be so laid back and so stoic and so uncaring that it leads me into situations that aren't necessarily the best or the most authentic, because I'm not being honest about the little things that like actually are building up, which that might just be, it could be repression. It could be like just lying or not telling what's really going on. And maybe it's not actually stoicism, but I think that there's, I think there's something there that's like interesting. It's a, it's an interesting balancing act. Cause I don't think stoicism is something that people should like cling to in any like strong sense of the word. But that said, if you're going to cling to something, I would recommend that over most things.
Yeah. No, stoicism, I mean, it's a very reputable kind of philosophy. Epicureanism is, as I say, as it's kind of like, main rival, or it was.
So what's, you said that's like a material philosophy versus stoicism, which is
kind of idealist. And so the Stoics kind of believe that beneath the flux of life and political life and whatever, there is an underlying harmony. There's an underlying kind of logos or reason.
Yeah.
And that what we need to do is connect with that. And interestingly, this led the Stoics to have a really interesting notion of God. They had kind of like three different ways of relating to this word. The first was, you know, don't fear the gods. So the Stoics said like, and don't fear the gods really means don't fear fate. So they were like, whatever happens in your life that you can't control, don't fear it.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
So God and fate were intertwined, obviously, in ancient Greece and today as well. And the notion is that if you're a Stoic, you can basically cope with any storms. So you don't have to fear God. You don't have to fight for the love of God, which means you don't have to fight against fate or for fate. You can, in a sense, find peace within you. Which, by the way, is very, very key, because there's an idea that we have that if only we could make our external world calm enough, then we'd be happy. So if someone suffers from insomnia, they think if only the room could be dark enough, if only the room would be quiet enough, if only I had the right rituals to do before I went to sleep, then I'd be able to sleep. But of course, for an insomniac, the idea is actually that there's some sort of inner issue. And so the room will never be dark enough, will never be quiet enough, there'll never be enough rituals. That actually, the trick is to get to a place where you have inner calm, so you can cope with a little bit of light, with a little bit of noise, you know? And so this notion we have often is, if only I can make my external circumstances calm enough, everything will be great. And the Stoics were like, no, what you have to do is make your inner world calm, and then you can cope with the storms of life. So that was the first notion, don't fear the gods.
No,
go ahead, do you want to say something about that?
I love my car very much, and it's like a material object that I take a lot of pride in, even though I don't clean it or wash it, even though I should. But I was leaving my parking garage and like slammed into the side of the pillar, and this happened like a week and a half ago. This was actually, I think, the night after I think it was Tuesday after Memorial Day, after I was madly in love with this girl. That you can hear more
still
about.
Going well.
It's going fantastic. Yeah. She's unbelievable. She's the light of my life. She's turned me around. I'm full Republican now. But anyway, I definitely like slammed my car into the pillar, and it wasn't one of those situations where there was nothing I could do about it, because I messed up and I did it and it was completely my fault and I feel like an idiot. And I definitely got out and looked at it and was like, and like said a bunch of swear words and probably just repeated it to myself 20 times. And then this was Memorial Day that this happened. Yeah, it was Monday morning. I didn't super care after that. And I was like, okay, cool. It is what it is. But then it kept coming back. It just kept coming back in the form of how little I cared about it.
Yeah.
So I kept being like, crap, I missed my car. Well, good thing I don't care about that. But I was like, no, I clearly care about it. Like, I'm very upset about it. So I don't know what that is, but it was one of those things of like, Well, I don't, you know, what can you do? It just is what it is. I'll get it fixed at some point, but what can you do?
Well, maybe you were being truly stoic, like in a sense of you were, because you're a pretty calm guy. You're like, okay, that's the storms of fate. You hit something.
That's what it is.
You accept it. You move on.
It's my hemlock. Yeah.
So that's the first thing is that, okay, don't fear the gods. And then the second one's much more interesting. It's actually you can be greater than the gods, that you can be...
blasphemy. The second one is
blasphemy. The second
one's
absolute blasphemy.
I know that one.
Yeah. You got taught that in your church.
Yeah.
But it's a really interesting idea, because then for Seneca, he's like, okay, this traditional notion of God is all powerful. You know, creates the universe, is incredibly almighty, omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent, all of that. Well, then Seneca turns around and says, okay, well, then a baby can be superior to God. You go, well, why is that? Well, he says, because a baby has to struggle to stand, struggle to speak. They have to have courage, the courage to hurt themselves, the courage to, you know, move forward. Whereas God has never experienced what it's like to try to walk, right? God is all powerful, immutable, created the universe. So it's kind of like if Mike Tyson, who's the last boxer I can think of, right? It beats me in a fight. Nobody's impressed. But if I beat Mike Tyson in a fight...
If you get one punch in.
Yeah, that would be like incredible. Because everybody goes like, oh yeah, well, Mike Tyson's, of course, he's really tough. He's going to beat him to a pulp. So in a weird way, it's like if you struggle and you find the inner calm and you're able to get through the storms of life, in one very weird sense, you're better than that object that can create an entire universe.
Yeah.
So that's the second notion.
That's fun.
Yeah. And then the third one is kind of like for someone who goes, oh, that's blasphemy. The third one is the view that, and actually by connecting with this calm, you connect with the underlying ground of everything, and therefore you experience God. So they're all different, slightly different notions of this word God, but it's really interesting, you know, like the Stoics aren't theistic or atheistic, but the original Stoics have these really interesting ways of thinking about, you know, what it means to affirm God.
Right. That's very interesting, man. That's fun.
Yeah.
I think it's, I got into the stuff, the Stoicism and the meditation and all that stuff as a result of a chaotic outer world, as a result of being, and I got into it specifically after, this book, specifically Stoicism, was like late last year, and like the book is interesting, and I read some of the meditations that Marcus Aurelius did, and it's all just like, what I like about it is it's so like, it is practical. Like it is something that you can and I think that's like the fun stuff about a lot of what we talk about is like, it's you can enact it on like a daily basis, whether it's like your car getting slammed into something or like whatever. But the meditation and the, you know, yoga and all that, I mean, I don't do yoga or anything, but like, it's a weird thing. It's fun. I really like it, but it's like the rituals. It is a ritual for sure. And I think that like you're saying, like the insomniac who has to have everything super quiet, that's fun. And like, I totally get that. But I feel like I do similar things with like being like, I'll go, if I haven't worked out in a little bit, and I do that. And I think, and mentally, one of the main reasons I do it is because I feel like if I do it, then it's my way of like exerting like whatever pent up anxieties there are. And then doing journaling also, and just like writing everything out, has helped me cope with like dealing with a bunch of people and like working with people one-on-one, because it's a way of like getting all that stuff out. But I don't know if that's actually opposite to Stoicism, because Stoicism would be like, no, you don't need to get all that stuff out. You know, it's already out. That's all out there. You just need to contact the calm that's in there. Whereas I'm like, no, there's actually like anxiety and crap that I'm trying to like get out by doing this so that I can function throughout the day. And also, I don't want to make it sound like I have some kind of weird healthy lifestyle, because I don't.
Yeah, you know, he definitely doesn't.
Yeah.
Well, this is getting closer to then one of my critiques with this return of Stoicism.
I was dog whistling you into it.
Yeah, I was like that. You. Thank you, sir. Mm-hmm. And it's good that you didn't signpost it.
Absolutely, we never would.
Yeah, that's good. That's a professional. Is that so? My friend of mine, a friend of ours, actually someone you know too, she is really interested in particularly the rise of meditation in contemporary American society. But let's also fold in the rise of Stoicism and yoga, all of this. And she's interested in it from a psychological perspective. She wants to write a thesis on this. And we were chatting about it. And she was saying that her son, all his friends experience anxiety. Loads of them are on tablets. Loads of them are engaged in various activities to get rid of a profound anxiety they experience in life. And so what's happened is there's been a revival of technologies that are designed to get rid of anxiety.
Yeah.
So stoicism is a technology of the self, but so is, you know, the westernized meditation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the problem, and we were talking about, I said, my problem is, because she was saying, like, there are studies coming out that show that it works, that a lot of these techniques lower anxiety, etc. And I was like, well, that's my real problem with them. The problem is not that they don't work, but that they do. Because what happens is, you get anxious because you're in a job that's demanding too much, that you've made everything into utilitarian value. You know, you drink coffee because you need energy to work, not because you enjoy it. You sleep to get energy to work. You know, you've suddenly commodified most of your existence.
Yeah.
And in this frenetic commodification of your entire existence, you feel profound anxiety. So the response is to create spaces in your life where you can minimize that anxiety. Why? Well, so that you can go back to your job and do it more effectively. So big corporations like Google and Twitter and Facebook and Microsoft, they all encourage meditation, stoicism. They even have some of these companies, they'll have yoga mats. They'll have places.
Retreats. Yeah,
yeah. You'll have even nap rooms. You go into your room to nap. So they're even making sleep into a commodity, you know, that you sleep for, you know, 20 minutes in the middle of work so that you can come back refreshed. And any time massive corporations do something, you can be damn sure it's not a revolutionary activity.
Yeah.
Because why the companies are doing it is so that they can make you a better worker and obviously make more money, right? Increase capital. So the concern for
increasing
me is...
increasing capital, thereby perpetuating...
yeah, your anxiety.
Some anxieties, yeah.
Yeah, so which means then you go on your yoga retreat to come back refreshed. So they're absolutely intertwined, right?
Man, you're,
So this stuff.
It's good stuff. It's like my problem with stoicism is that it's perpetuating capitalism. Is that basically the
Now, and the original Stoics, there was even within original Stoicism, this was a problem because Stoics accept everybody as equal, and they were like pro, you know, being lenient to slaves. I mean, ultimately to abolishing slavery. You know, they were all about equality. We're all equal. But we're like that today. I mean, in a sense, subjectively, when you're in work, we're all equal. You know, you don't call your boss boss. You call them by their name, right? If you're in a religious, contemporary religious situation, the person's not called the great white goat. You call the pastor by their first name. They're just like you, right? So subjectively, we all treat ourselves as equal, but actually structurally, we don't. Your boss is still your boss and can fire you. The person might not be called the great white goat, but everybody knows they're the one that's in power.
Yeah.
So for the Stoics, there was this weird thing where they weren't very politically engaged. They were able to accept everybody subjectively. They were able to disengage from the freneticism of their life, but they were powerless to change the world. They seemed to just let kind of systematic issues perpetuate.
I wonder if there's something to be said for, like, and this is not like, I want to hear what you say about this, because in my experience, and I've talked about this a lot in work, because we're at the Valley Folk, we're doing like, there's a lot of like business stuff that none of us have ever really had to cope with. And we're learning very quickly, and it's so fun, and I love it very much. But I am a believer that like channels in your brain can get clogged up by certain things,
It's a very weird reference to both a Peep Show episode and also to a guy called Reich, and basically an idea that there is this force that clogs the world. Anyway, it's a joke that virtually nobody got.
Well, for those of you who did get it, or for those of you who are interested in Peep Show, it truly is one of the best television shows.
Oh, I would love to do an episode where we at least talk about Peep Show.
Yeah, we could do a series on like a few episodes or something.
Because it's all about the unconscious.
Let people know what the episodes are and watch. Because it's on Netflix, right?
It is.
Yeah.
But you Americans don't watch it because you don't know how good it is.
For those of you who don't believe him, you are completely right. It is an amazing show.
Very insightful.
Oh my God. It's the smartest comedy that I think maybe ever seen. And you should watch Barry.
Haven't seen that. No, yeah, I'd like to see that.
But in my experience, when you do the meditation, when you do the stoicism, you do the whatever it is that helps you feel calm within the storm, I can only hope from an optimistic perspective if it truly does work. Yeah. And I'm right about there being channels and you needing energy to be your best version of yourself. Like if you're tired, you're not going to be as good. If you're consumed by your outside world, you're not going to be as good. So do you see any hope that in doing, you know, going into the nap rooms at Google or like going on the retreat at Twitter that, you know, that the Silicon Valley kind of hippy dippy, like stoic stuff. Don't you think that a potential benefit of that is that if it does work and people are able to sort of like become calm and like become serene and their minds can be or feel a little emptier, that it would leave room to have a more honest critique about what they're actually doing with their lives and what they're actually wanting to like, why are they wanting to go back to work and do coding or whatever it is, or Amazon fulfillment, you know?
You worry for me, you've seen the film Collateral. Have you? Tom Cruise.
Like forever.
I mean, my movie references are all old, but I remember it was a good movie. And I remember that the idea is a taxi driver is taking an assassin around a city. He's killing a whole pile of people, right? And at one stage, they have a conversation and we find out that this taxi driver wants to set up his own business, which is going to be limousines. Instead of being a taxi driver, he's going to have a company. He's going to drive around wealthy people. Yeah. And this is his dream. And he's got a picture of the limo on his car, etc. And he thinks that this dream is the thing that he's wanting to get. And there's a point where the assassin and him are talking and the taxi driver's being judgmental about the assassin. And the assassin's
so like that.
I know, very judgmental. Yeah. And the assassin says, listen, you know, what's this picture of the limo, whatever? And the guy goes, oh, nothing. He says, tell me about it. You want to set up this limo company. You want to do X, Y, and Z. He says, yes. He says, you'll never do it. He says, you're sitting here in this little cab. You're driving around and you have this dream of a limo. You have this dream of a company. You've even lied to your mum telling her that you already have it. He says, you think that you're going to do it. He says, you're going to wake up in 40 years time, still sitting with a beer in your hand, never having done anything. Basically, the dream of you leaving your work is the very thing that keeps you in your work. Mm-hmm. So it's like the guy who says always, I want to leave my work and travel the world. That is the fantasy that he's generating that allows him to cope with being in his work. It's actually the person who doesn't say anything, who's more likely to leave, who lets it explode. Give me one more thing to say to convince you, because you're not convinced.
I'm not.
The question here for me is whether we want to minimize our anxiety or mobilize our anxiety. So a lot of the techniques that are used within contemporary American society are designed to minimize anxiety. But in minimizing anxiety, that allows you to be more comfortable with whatever you're currently doing, right? You're anxious, so you minimize your anxiety, you're able to keep going.
Yeah.
Holidays are a perfect example. You have a holiday for 2 weeks, allows you to go back to work, right? Everyone dreams of the holiday and then they reminisce on it. But within other disciplines, psychoanalysis being one of them, that is a technology that is not designed to minimize your anxiety to get you into the world, but is to mobilize your anxiety so that you can change it. So most people feel that they're in the world, but not of it. And then some technologies and some therapies are designed to help you feel more in your world. Mm-hmm. Whereas in psychoanalysis, the idea is actually to help you enjoy not fitting in your world.
Yeah.
And allowing that to become to basically weaponize your anxiety so that it can make a change. That's the argument.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, from what I understand of what you just said, some of it I feel like if you, the taxi driver thing with like, so he sees the limo or whatever and that, but I just feel like, I feel like that's different. Is that not different? Like that's not the practices of stoicism. Could you make a case for, like, let's say the taxi driver, instead of, you know, pining every day for that and using it as something to always aspire to, which I totally believe. It's like the whole idea of working and this ridiculous industry is essentially like that I see all the time with my friends is like, well, the industry hasn't called me yet to give me my movie deal, and therefore I'm going to sit around and do nothing because what else am I supposed to? And then like the oh, that's what I want allows them, gives them comfort in doing absolutely nothing or perpetuating their stagnation.
Yeah.
But I would submit that maybe if you were to do certain practices, could that taxi driver not wake up one day and go, with a clear head, with an understanding that he's gotten himself into this situation, with an understanding that it's up to him to get it done and not his outside circumstances, which I believe is something that Stoicism kind of would, or at least attempts to lead people toward. Would that not sort of break that perpetual, or, you know, like thing? Yeah. Like, wouldn't it still benefit him in some way to cause him to be able to see things that he previously wasn't seeing?
Yeah, and okay, to bring something positive out of this thing and go like, if your anxiety levels are too high, you're not going to be able to change anything. But I would say if your anxiety levels are too low, you accept too much.
You just won't change anything. So, yeah, yep. So I see what you're saying.
But so Stoicism, and I think the way you use it, because you also do psychoanalysis, is a little bit, mm-hmm. is you know, it allows you to minimize anxiety that to a certain level it allows action to take place. But it's like the difference between a holiday and a festival. I run festivals, and the reason why I run festivals...
Oh, this is a fun... Yeah, I know what you're about to say. This is cool.
Oh, have we talked about this before?
Yeah, just in private. I don't think on the podcast.
Oh, right. Okay, that's good.
In private,
yes.
Behind closed doors.
Because in a sense, a holiday in its traditional form is a way for people to feel peace and lack of anxiety, recharge their batteries, and then go back into their world.
Take Instagram photos.
Yeah, oh yeah, do a bit of that, absolutely. Because there is a pleasure in the substitute idea of people thinking you're having pleasure.
Yeah,
that's a very pleasurable thing.
It's most of my pleasure.
Yeah, I mean, I often, for some people, if you ask them, would you prefer to have the life of like sitting on a beach and enjoying yourself and being on yachts, or being able to pretend you have that life on social media, some people would find it very difficult to make the choice.
I know.
Yeah. And that's it. That we should do an episode on that.
Oh
that
yeah.
Means.
That's rife.
Yeah. But, what was I saying? Oh yeah. Holiday. It's this kind of like, it actually feeds into keeping you the way things are. So it's a conservative, holidays are inherently conservative phenomenon.
I mean, it's the whole idea of the weekend, right? It's everybody's working for the weekend, and it's like, oh man, if I only had 3 days, a 3 day weekend, then that'd be good. And it's like, no, you wouldn't.
That's it. Yeah. Weekend is an inherently conservative thing, as in the weekend of Friday night, I go out, get drunk, Saturday night ideas. And you think you're being a rebel, like I'm out getting drunk, I'm sleeping around, I'm cool.
Yeah.
But actually it's inherently conservative because that's the very gas release valve that allows you to go back into your 9-to-5 Monday to Friday rule.
And you can't have a gas relief valve if you're not in the machine.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, so the machine allows it. That's why you're always allowed to break the law a bit, drive a little bit over the speed limit or whatever, is that that's actually facilitates our being grafted into mm-hmm. the system.
Yeah, something you're breaking that is real.
So there's always acceptable laws to break and unacceptable laws. So the trick is, I mean, it's the whole protest thing, is that certain protests are allowed by the system, so they're not a protest. Because as long as you turn up at a certain time, leave at a certain time, and there's protests that aren't. Anyway, a holiday then, like a weekend, is inherently conservative in its traditional form. But if the festivals I run are designed to be slightly different, which is you go away, you experience relaxation, fun, etc., but it's designed to spark a change in the rest of your life. It's not designed to recharge your batteries so that you can go back into the job, relationship, world that's destroying you,
mm-hmm.
but that sparks off the ability to change those things. And part of it is to mobilize your anxiety and to allow you to enjoy your anxiety. Because here's the problem. Your problem within, Google, for example, where you're working hard and the weekend you go to your retreat, right? Is that it's connecting, it's making a disconnect between anxiety and peace.
Right.
Peace is kind of like the weekend, the anxiety is the work, and they're opposites. But the trick is to go, they're never opposites, they're intertwined.
Yeah.
And actually, how do we intertwine them properly and enjoy the intertwining in such a way that the anxiety is weaponized for change?
Yep, that's great. That's beautiful. I think that's very good. I would say that I've been on vacations that when my, after my head has been clear, it's made me go, oh, this is what I, but I also, I mean, who knows how, you know, any, yeah. any pushback I'm giving is completely subjective, but like in my experience, I've been on vacations yeah. or I've been at the beach and like, I can get very calm. And in doing so, I can then go, oh, I need to do this, 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 this. Like, this is yeah. what I want to do. Like, this is what my soul wants. Yes. Or, you know, for lack of a better word. And I, when that happens, it does make me, like, I go to Florida every year in July. And yeah. My whole, like, extended family is there, and it's really awesome. And it's, I go to Longboat Key. It's very fun, and I'm very excited for this year, and it's over 4th of July. But inevitably, like, I'll go out and I'll just, like, every day go on these, like, long walks and blah, 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 and it's beautiful, and I love yeah. it. And the sunsets in Florida are amazing. And so then when I come back, I have that, I would venture to say, a mobilization. However, if I'm being completely honest, I can't say that it actually lasts. And I would imagine that that's what most people's experience are. Like, you go on vacation, yeah. you come back, you have a pop of hyper productivity, then you're back to your monotonous run waiting for the next vacation
yeah.
to happen.
And also, yeah, and connected with this is an important point you're bringing up, is the difference between theory and practice. So there's like what scientists do often, of course, is they're trying to find the universal truth. But then when you get into doing experimentation, you find practical life, you know, results in lots of things. So what you do is, if you're a social scientist, you survey 1,000 people because you're trying to find the universal, but there'll be particular exceptions, mm-hmm. right? So in the same way, what we're talking about here, it's like you're talking about the theory of what makes a good teacher, but also bad teachers produce the odd good student, and yeah. good teachers produce the odd bad student. So one sense, we're talking very abstractly about, you know, the weekend is inherently conservative, but in practice, it isn't for everybody.
Right.
And
that's what it is. Yeah.
yeah. But by and large, you go, oh, we're talking about these abstractions that affect us to a certain extent. So in other words, how do I make my weekend not this gas release valve? How do I do a form of meditation that helps? And I think actually you're a good example. So you do meditation, you read Stoicism, you do psychoanalysis, mm-hmm. you do journaling. And like this combination, this cocktail that you're making, at its best lowers your anxiety to a level where you can look at things, but also with, say, the technology of analysis, causes you to have enough anxiety to go, I want to change that. Mm-hmm. I want to change up what I'm doing with my life. I want to make these changes. So there's, you know, this theory we're talking about is hopefully just useful to people to go, oh yeah, this is parts of my life that act as the gas release valve, the conservative thing that keeps me in my work. Oh, but I play poker on a Thursday night with my mates, and when I play poker with them, I talk about how my life is not working, and, yeah. and that encourages me to change things. So I should lean into that.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's very nice.
It's messy in real life.
It's messy, and it's also, there's so much more, and I think it's because there's culturally, we're in such a weird, chaotic time right now. You ever just think, maybe was it always crazy and we just never noticed it, and now everybody, because of the internet's freaking out because it's the information superhighway. You know what I'm talking about? Actually, I don't know. I go back and forth on that. But
I think in different epochs, it's different anxieties. There's always something, but that's what Paul Tillich talks about. He says, like, there's a point where our main worry was death, because death was all around. You saw people die, yeah. your lifespan. But that's less so in the 20th century.
At
meaninglessness.
In this society.
Yeah. Meaninglessness is the primary anxiety producer. So yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, we're all freaking out about everything right now. And I think then that causes this sort of like rise in Stoicism, but in that rise is also kind of like a almost like a fundamentalist approach to it, where it seems like people are, I've had people on the internet who have like pissed me off or something, and I'll say something back to them that's snarky and asshole-y, and then they'll respond with something that I can tell they've been like, I'm like you can kind of sniff out the Stoicism sometimes, where you're just like, I know what you've been reading. Like, I know what you're doing right now, and I don't accept it, and I don't like it. But it's like, people can become so attached to it that they use it as like a shield, and they use it as a way to like hide behind, you know, they use it as like a formula to make every response or every action in their life. And it's like, I don't ever want to walk out and be like, you know, something happens, and then I'd be like, okay, what would like a Stoic do? What would be the Stoic thing to do right now? Because I just feel like that's that's the opposite of what it should be. Yeah. Like if, in my mind, it should just be like, you read the stuff, you do it, you hopefully it works in some way and with a mixture of whatever else you're doing and whatever other anxieties you have that you can't ignore. And then somewhere in the midst of it, you end up having a more happier life without like necessarily labeling it. Like I love this stuff, but I always hesitate when people are like, talk, you know, what do you think about stoicism? I didn't know about stoicism until somebody told me I was like a stoic.
Yeah.
And then somebody else got me the book on stoic that was completely independent of the other person. And I was like, then I got me into it, but it was like a more of like a learning about myself thing. And I had no idea. I was like, I don't know what stoic is. And I read it. I was like, oh, this is cool. I like it. Yeah. This lines up. But that's also like the Myers-Briggs test where you get the results. And you're like, that is me. And it's like, you just answered.
I mean,
you answered 75 questions.
Yeah. I mean, stoicism, I say, as a philosophical movement is fascinating. But on social media, this is a good example of where I think stoicism is connected with high anxiety. Because have you ever seen a Twitter account where the person will quote things like about, you know, always forgive or, you know, remain calm or all of this stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the next tweet's like shouting and screaming at somebody.
Yeah, right? It's really fun.
Yeah. Now, the reason for that, I don't think that that's so much hypocrisy or a person's fragmented ego. I think it's an expression of how these two are connected, i.e. people get so worked up on, say, Twitter. We get worked up for legitimate reasons, right? So much anxiety in the world. And then what we do is then we run to some practice. So weirdly, and it's funny whenever you see it on a Twitter line, because you can actually chart it.
Yeah.
Someone's going crazy, i.e. their anxiety is through the roof. And then their alternative, like, we should all like love everybody and remain calm. And this is my issue, is that actually in analysis, the idea is how do you not ratchet up your anxiety to such a high level that then you need to try to get the fantasy of getting rid of it? But how do you keep it at a level that is, that doesn't like blow up and demonize people, but doesn't go so low that you go like, I don't care. I don't care about anything. I just care about having a good time. But interestingly, remain in this weird level where you're a bit dissatisfied, but you're satisfied by your dissatisfaction. Like you enjoy it. You enjoy a bit of you enjoy a bit of the back and forth.
Yeah, there's we go back and forth right now. I was talking to my buddy Joe about like, you know, moving forward and how to like bring people into our team and who to work with and who not to work with. And something that like I happen to firmly believe is like, we were having a discussion about somebody who maybe is a little, the crazy person. Mm-hmm. And like they had definitely have like a craziness to them.
Yeah.
And it was one of those things of like, well, just, you know, like they can X, Y, and Z, and sometimes they do this and that. And I was like, I like that. Like, let's create an environment, or let's create a system where we know that we are getting involved on some level with people who are, because for one, we're trying to make a comedy thing, and I don't believe that we're going to make a comedy thing by hiring like boring people. But I'm like, if we can create a world where we can exist in this sort of exist in the tension, but also like see the weirdness, and then like, I don't know, like and not mind it and just exist with it, I think it just sparks more creativity, which is the opposite, I would imagine, of stoicism. It's like, let's invite some anxiety, let's invite some problems into our circumstances. Nothing bad, nothing crazy, but enough that it keeps it interesting. And it's like, and that's like the fun stuff.
Yes, that's called like the mobilization of hysteria, which is because the hysteric is a person who is in the world but not of it. So a perverse person, they're really in the world, they find it really easy to be in the world. A psychotic person is generally way outside the world, they're mental, you know, they're like they're creating a worldview which doesn't fit with any other world. But the neurotic person is in the world but not of it. They're in their work, but they've got a bad back and they get migraines that tell them that they don't enjoy their work, or they're in a relationship but they question it. So they're in this place of being in the world but not of it. But that's incredibly productive, or it can be.
Yeah.
If you can mobilize that, then you can actually make changes. So bringing in a little bit of crazy, we should enjoy our crazy. Like whenever the little bits of us not fitting into the world, that's where the change can happen.
Remember the last girl I went out with, I told her that I was attracted to crazy, and that there's a thing that's happening where we're trying to minimize crazy in our culture to the point that it makes it less enjoyable for me because I know that about myself, only because I was told by my friends based off of my objective actions that I definitely have a tendency to enjoy a certain element of that and of chaos. And then it turned out that she was a con artist. Yes.
I was going to say, like, in terms of your saying about, you know, we're trying to minimize craziness, this is actually why you could say that we live in quite a perverse society, because the perverse structure is where you fit into the world, but you have one area of your life where you can transgress. So you go to your fetish bar at the weekend, or you do whatever, right? Now, as long as you have that one space of transgression, you can then be the judge, you can be the lawyer, you can integrate into your world. And we live in a society where, in a sense, that's what's happening, is you can be crazy on a Friday night. You can go, you know, go crazy at, like, in these very specific things and times and places. You can break the law with, which is in ways that are allowed. And the very space where there's a little bit of transgression allows you to then, like, go into the rest of the world and change it. So what you're basically doing is domesticating the crazy by putting the crazy on your Friday night. Mm-hmm. So you have these people go, I go out and I get drunk and I have sex and I take drugs and I do this.
I'm crazy, I'm wild. You know, I gotta be working 9 a.m.
Yeah, we stole cones from the street and put them on our heads. Yeah. And it was like,
we're nuts. Cones on the street.
Yeah, the ultimate transgressive activity. Yeah.
Dude, easy, yeah, man. We're trying to keep it family friendly. Yeah. Pete's talking about grabbing cones on the street.
So what happens is, because that's actually allowable by society, because that's the gas release valve. Yep. The perverse structure where you're allowed to do the crazy on a Friday night, and then all week you just integrate back into the system that might be destructive to you and to everybody else.
That's so funny. Yeah, it's like it's my Vegas thing where I'm always talking about, how long have I been talking about, like, we gotta go.
Yeah.
We gotta go to Vegas. And it's like, I have to go, otherwise I'm just like, but it's like, I'm, you know, I'll do all this stoic stuff. But yeah. Like, I'm definitely gonna go to Vegas and be, you know, party and have a great time.
That's true. Yeah, Vegas, in America, Vegas kind of functions as the ultimate conservative space, because it's the ultimate place where you go, right, oh my goodness, let's go to Vegas and spend a weekend going crazy, doing things we wouldn't do, infidelities, all of this.
The best too is when you go to Vegas and you see varying levels of crazy. That's fascinating. Or like people going crazy in very muted ways. And it kind of, like, you know, this is going to go off on a bit of a tangent, but like, one of my favorite things about Las Vegas is the deadness of certain times of day, and sort of seeing the look on people's faces who've clearly never been there before, and they're from the Midwest, and like, they're like having a Miller Lite, and they're like, we are going nuts. Yeah. And I'm like, and then on the other side of that is, I'm on, you know, they're on that end of the spectrum of like, that's their release valve. And then I'm on my end of the release valve, which is pretty, like, you know, I like
doing Red Snake on roulette.
Doing Red Snake on roulette, basically. and drinking Jack and diets and having a great time. And then there's the up.
It's amazing that we have actually cracked roulette, by the way.
Isn't that nuts?
That's good.
People don't know.
Yeah. It's the Red Snake.
Yeah. If you're can't listening lose. And you're going to Vegas, yeah, you can just do the Red Snake on roulette and you cannot lose.
Don't tell people, don't tell us casinos, but like, if they see you doing it, they're going to kick you out. They're going to ask you to leave, because it's just a surefire way of winning.
Yeah, 100% of the time. I've lost, man. Yeah. The Red Snake is always, I think the Red Snake comes and goes like a snake, and it
doesn't always work.
It doesn't, but it feels that way, where it's like, when it's working, man,
it's always working.
It's always working.
The problem is when it's not working, it doesn't work.
It never works.
But when it's working, it always works.
Oh, it's perfect. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway. Oh yeah. But the point you're making is perfect. It's great. Is that Las Vegas then functions within a society in a perverse way, that you have this, you have to have the space, like, in the cultural imagination, the space where you go to be crazy. And even if you never go to Vegas, even knowing that it's there.
It's like, sometimes, I don't know if we've talked about it on the podcast, but like, JBP, Jordan B. Peterson, and like, his sort of like, you know, everything is calm and everything is fine. Yeah. But like, I'm always looking at him and I'm like, I think I'm like, this guy like skins cats or something. Like, there's just no way.
Yeah.
And it's like, and you can, or he like, you know, he dresses, now he's dressing differently and he's got that whole thing, and, you know, whatever, I'm not going to get into him, but like, I think that there's like it's funny. I'm like, there's something.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. I said this to my friend Rob, who I'm on tour with, a really good friend of mine, but I made a joke on the tour where I said, listen, this guy's so nice, it's obvious that he's got bodies buried somewhere.
Yeah.
And afterwards he was like, you know, maybe you shouldn't say that. And I was like, do you have bodies buried somewhere? Have I just hit on it? So I'm just letting you know.
You know, you're not helping your case about
The fact that you're concerned about this makes me think, yeah, that's right. Although I genuinely think he's just such a nice guy, but maybe there's one body buried.
We all have bodies, yeah. Dude, when I read I read one before I came out here while you were frantically preparing for this episode, but I read it, and there's times when I read it where I'm just like, you know, it's these quotes from the Stoics and these very wise philosophers, and there's like a reflection on it. And when I'm done, it's called the Daily Stoic, by the way, if you're interested, it's really nice. But where sometimes when I read it, and I'm like, I don't want to be this. Mm-hmm. This doesn't sound good. And I like that too. I like but that's also my being like cool for school to commit to one particular thing.
I had a non-Stoic moment yesterday, which I was telling you about, where I was down by the pool.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, let's dive into that. Dr. Rollins.
Appropriate.
Author of, then I just like I want to list all your like accomplishments and then have you tell this story.
Creates
a contrast.
I have been, I got to say, I've got really back. For a while, I was working and traveling and I was out of the way of reading, and mm-hmm. I missed that, and I've kind of like got back into it. And I, at the moment, it's beautiful weather, so I like to go downstairs and I like to sit in the shade, read.
Yeah.
And I was down there by the pool, humble brag.
Yeah.
And a whole pile of guys came into the pool. I'd been there a couple hours, and then one of them, they came in. I've been there a couple of hours.
Nice, man.
But in the shade, because I would burn otherwise.
Yeah, you're looking good. You have color.
I've got
on
a bit
face.
Of color. Yeah, I'm liking this. Good. I've never really had color before. It's good. So I'm down there. They bring a big, you know, stereo system. I'm like, oh dear, this is going to be a bit rubbish. And then they bring a ball.
And
I'm like,
ball.
Oh right, this not is not good. And then one of them dive bombs into the pool and splashes the water all over me and Mm-mm. my computer's beside Mm-mm. me. Thankfully, in its Ooh, bag. But
big cup of no.
Yeah. So if I'd been Stoic, which I'm kind of a bit against, I would have perhaps just gone, well, that's life. But mm-hmm. I didn't.
Yeah.
I confronted the person. Ooh. And
what did you say?
Well, I can't say everything I said, but I did say, excuse me, sir, I'd like to, could I have your attention, gentlemen?
Pardon me. I'm feeling perturbed by some of your actions as of late.
Yes, and so I communicated that, and I told them that I felt that what they were doing was not being considerate to the other people who were at the pool.
So calm and stoic.
I was a very stoic response. But I said it in a more, let's call it, impassioned way.
Colorful
way. They were young. They were very much, it was funny because they're very well built. They obviously work out and they're probably in their 20s. And they're just having a laugh, you know, I understand.
Then what happened? How did they respond? What did they do?
Well, it was interesting. So then I had to leave because I got a phone call, but I walked past one of the guys and one of them said, oh, do you want to fight him? But he was joking. He wasn't being serious. He said, oh, you know, have a fight. So he was actually trying to lighten the mood.
Okay,
so I appreciated that. He was lightening the mood. And the other guy, he apologized. Now, he didn't look me in the eye. They were laughing. They obviously thought I was this old grumpy guy, but he did, without looking me in the eye, but he did a kind of apologize. Oh yeah, sorry, mate. And you know,
not looking in the eyes, which is just, of course, code for you obviously in that moment were the alpha male around a bunch of cubs who were trying very hard to prove their own alphaness.
Well, I like that you say that, but these guys, each of them could crush me in a second.
Yes, but there are varying versions of alpha.
Well, I think to be honest, not that we're big respecters of age, but I am like an old man in relation to them, 15 years older. So there's probably just this thing where I kind of told them that they probably knew they'd done something wrong and he was a bit embarrassed.
15 years, you think?
Well, maybe not, but good.
I bet
10
they were babies.
Them.
I bet they were a little younger than
younger than that?
Yeah, I think they are younger.
Than 20? 20, 30? No, 30? Oh my goodness.
I was just like, are you just doing a thing where you're... Sure, yeah.
I love the look of it. Should I let this pass?
Are you
trying to pretend everybody you're 35 years old?
It's a hard turn on your brand, but yeah, man, you're killing it at 32 or whatever.
Yeah, I'm 32 years old, yeah. Okay, my goodness, that's right. I'm not old.
You think 50 years?
I could be 25 years older than them.
Yeah, you could be.
That is, because I am an old man in relation to this apartment block, by the way.
Yeah, well, me too, dude. I mean, and you're older than me. And I feel like I look at these, I mean, I would have, in that moment, I would have, so here's, this is a great, I think a great thing, because if you had done the Stoic thing.
Well, then nothing would have changed.
Nothing would have changed, yeah. And you wouldn't have even, the opportunity that you gave for, you know, bro number two to attempt to lighten the mood with his version of a joke or his version of a, you know, created a moment in life,
yes,
which is cool.
And then, in fairness to the we're talking about like modern stoicism here, but in fairness to that, and in fairness to, is like, if I got so like uptight, it would have been no value. Like whenever that guy said, "Oh, you want to fight him?" I'd be like, "Yeah, do you want to fight him?"
Right,
and I'd be doing my Irish kind of like whatever. And it would have been too bad. So in one sense, you go like, well, no, a bit of kind of the stoic attitude of like, you call something out, but you neither get so ratcheted up that like you just cause an absolute conflict and now none of us can talk to each other down there or whatever. So you don't do that, and neither do you have such a like, you know, who cares that the place becomes like this crazy party place and you mm-hmm. can't use it anymore. But there's that, how do you have your anxiety at a level where you're able to confront things but without getting too caught up in it?
Yeah.
And it's tough in practice to do it, but
yeah, it's tough in practice. We talk a lot about that in like the being in public and being actually having interactions with people, especially if you're not coming from a place where I come from 99% of the time, which is I just hope this person likes me, or I just hope that this goes okay. But if you actually are being truly yourself and you're expressing like some kind of anger, some kind of frustration with somebody, that seems to be the place where the majority of life happens. I know McGowan talked about that a little bit, but like there's in public is where who you actually are, like when it hits the world, and then that you can get really fun moments that you end up remembering when you're like dying, hopefully, I guess,
yeah,
at the end of your life, instead of just being like, oh, I was really nice to everybody. But that's my problem. I mean, the stoicism thing has been at times an obstacle where it's like, I can't, you know, I find I mute my language. I get very like, oh, they're fine. I justify other people's actions. And I know that's not technically stoicism, but I do think that stoicism can support the bad habits of not expressing how bad things actually are sometimes.
I mean, here's a funny thing about, like, there's some Stoic writers who say the same thing, but I'm a big fan of Zen Buddhism in some ways. I kind of really like it, but you read some Zen Buddhist thinkers like Suzuki or whatever, and you find out, and Zizek talks about this in very, very beautifully, but that some of the Zen stuff was used by, you know, Japanese army to torture people. And this idea that the sword does not kill your enemy. You know, you do not kill your enemy. The sword kills your enemy.
Yeah,
you are simply, in a sense, the movement of energy through the universe. And what kind of happens is it becomes a technique that can be used for great good and great evil. And in the same way, you read some of the Stoics and it's like there's a beautiful acceptance and there's a beautiful kind of like, everybody is equal, etc. But there can also be, in the writings, you notice this kind of like detachment.
Such a detachment,
which then allows, say, at a subjective level, there's you know, equality is affirmed. But at the objective level, of the structural level, it continues to be perpetuated. And I'm saying that as someone who's actually a fan of like a lot of Zen. I think Zen's one of the most interesting kind of aspects of Buddhism. And I'm also saying, as someone who's a bit of a fan of Stoicism, but
yeah,
it's interesting to hear.
Yeah, yeah. It's fun to hear what you kind of like and don't like about certain things.
But I am more Epicurean. If we haven't got into that, but I of those two schools, I'm more of that
because
that
Epicurean is probably what would be more Lacanian, and Stoicism would be kind of union.
Well, yeah, definitely Stoicism would yet be connected more with that Jungian kind of notion, also within Gnosticism, New Age spirituality, you know, all of that. Is it not that Stoicism is much more, you know, subtle, but it does have elements of that.
Speaks to an overall harmony.
Yeah, whereas Epicureanism has much more of roots in the kind of existentialism and Marxist kind of thing and psychoanalytic ideas. So
very fun stuff. Wow, good times. I had a thought, but I forget what it was. In regard to the idea of like the detachment of like the sword or whatever.
Yeah.
I like the idea of, because I think a lot about time, especially with like relationships and stuff and being in that world and life itself is adult life is weird and difficult, but one of the metaphors that I really like that I think is a combination of Stoicism and kind of maybe what you're talking about, the psychoanalytic thing, and it's a very simple, dumb metaphor that it could either be useful to people or not, but it's this idea that, like, you have all of these, like, emotional IEDs on you that are strapped to you a little bit, and it's like you can go through life and you carry them with you, like you carry all this stuff and you carry the heartbreak and you carry the anxieties, and Stoicism can teach you to sort of, like, in my experience, not be so affected by these explosive things that are on you, but also in doing so, you don't ignore the fact that there is somebody annoying you at the pool, or it does suck that I messed up my car, and you can go and you can kind of, like, hold those, like, things on you, and then you can feel all of that anxiety, you can feel all of that, like, guilt or remorse or sad, and, like, then you can just learn to let it go. But I feel like we're in a people are trying to pretend that there's no IEDs on you. It's like the Stoicism thing is a way of almost being like taking off the entire vest and being like, oh no, I'm completely free of all those things. And that detachment can lead to, I think, a very muted life. But if you can use it while also maintaining all of the pressures that come with life, and then bounce and be able to go and touch it and feel it and go from there, then I feel like that's a better a way of looking at it than just being like all the time.
That's good, and that connects with Paul Tillich's critique of Stoicism.
I was going
to
say,
well, exactly. You were just about
to leading,
say it.
Yeah, you cut me off.
Yeah, but his main critique is someone who very much respects it, but is that in contemporary 20th century Western society, with our existential angst and anxiety, his main argument is that Stoicism is not possible for most people. That most of us, it's like, how do I say it? It's like the Stoicism of saying, I'm comfortable with my own death. I'm comfortable with the passing of life.
Yeah, it's like, I don't believe you.
Well, yeah, well, Tillich thinks it was possible at various points to have that, yeah. But for him, he argues that in the 20th century, with the First and the Second World War and various other things that have happened, that Stoicism generally... our anxiety and our questioning and our cynicism, it always trumps it. It can never be fully got rid of.
Yeah.
And that, so the trick is, how do we, and the whole book, The Courage to Be, is about this, is how do we, instead of trying to, as you say, take the vest off, which for most of us, and he I think he would say for some people, Stoicism is still an existential possibility to some extent, but he would say, but how do we live with it and take away its explosive power?
Yeah,
that's the trick.
So it's not blowing up in your face all the time. Yeah.
So that's I think the challenge, and maybe that's kind of my takeaway. I mean, are we at the point of takeaways?
Yeah. So we're right at an hour 2 minutes.
Oh, very nice. Well, then I'll do this as my takeaway. Then is that I think for most of us today, the challenge is not so much to always seek ways to minimize our anxiety through getting drunk, through going to the cinema, through taking drugs. Yeah, we all do a little bit of that, and there's nothing wrong with a bit of that. But if we get caught up with minimizing our anxiety, then what happens is we can remain indifferent to our world and our environment and continue to, like, feed into it. That actually what we need to do is find ways of mobilizing our anxiety to make concrete changes in our life, realizing that we'll never completely get rid of anxiety, but we can make it work for us.
Yeah.
So we mobilize it and we enjoy it rather than minimizing it, which ultimately can lead to a very conservative structure where we continue to stay in a life that is damaging to us.
Yeah, that's very good.
There you go.
Any thoughts I had are kind of like in my just own personal experience, it's a very fun thing to do sometimes. Like, it's a very, all this stuff, whether it's the psychoanalysis, the Stoicism, the reading, you know, all of the books and the meditation, like the exercise, I think all of it really kind of, not all of it, but a lot of it boils down to whether or not you look at all of these things as a, oh my God, I need to do it because I have so much anxiety, and in doing that, I think it can lead you down a tough path, but sometimes that's what it takes to get there. But anyway, I think it's fun. Like, it's a fun life. It's the cocktail metaphor of just like, let's do all this stuff. It adds to it. Let's go to Vegas. Let's have some drinks. Let's go out tonight. Let's, you know, see a movie at midnight or whatever. Yeah. Like all, like just treating all of it with a lighter, more fun touch is enjoyable for me. And stoicism is for sure part of that. And I think it's very useful and very good. And I like it a lot. And I look forward to when I do my guided meditation for you later, Peter.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
We'll find your,
I'll find my inner Gary.
Your inner Gary.
Yeah. Can't wait to meet him.
When I said spirit guide, I said Gary, which is the name of my therapist.
Oh, is that right?
Isn't that fun?
I was wondering whether it was a spirit animal, like it was a penguin called Gary or something.
It's also a penguin.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, it's what's the word in Harry Potter?
I've never.
Patronus. Your Patronus.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, very good.
Anyway,
well, thanks very much. I like the way we had like a positive looking stoicism, a little bit of critical looking stoicism. You're wrong, I'm correct, but that's fine. I don't mind that.
And, absolutely.
You know, people can hear a mix of the truth and lies.
And I'm happier than you are. And actually, I don't think that's really very much on part. Bye, everybody.